Today at Radio Verulam, we are once again speaking to one of your local politicians, and I'm welcoming Shadow Home Affairs Minister Whip and Labour MP Bambos Charalambos to get the answers to your questions. Remember as well, if you've not been lucky enough to get an answer from Bambos this time, he will be back again next month fielding your questions. And as always, we invite you to send in your questions. You can send them in right now to jason.mckenna@radioverulam.com, and we will bank them and keep them in the system for next month's interview. But before we get on to the discussions about politics, I always do ask during these times, Bambos, how have you been keeping and how has this month been for work in lockdown?
Well, thanks, Jason, for having me again. Because I'm a whip, I have to go in. So this week I've been in Parliament every day bar today. It has been very busy. And this week in particular has been very busy because we had the announcement about the roadmap out of lockdown, and also the education route map out of lockdown as well for schools. Schools and educational institutions, I should say. It has been very busy, and that's on top of dealing with casework and having votes and other things. So it has been quite busy. And people still have concerns. We've got the budget coming up soon, and people have got concerns about support they're going to get for their businesses and other support that will be out there. So it has been quite a busy time. Lots of people with questions, lots of uncertainty, but I hope you'll get through that soon.
Possibly adding to the certainty within your life, Bambos, and to your families as well. Have you got a vaccination date yet? And have any of your family members had the vaccine so far?
Well, yes, I had the vaccine. So I had the Pfizer jab, it was very efficient, very quick. It was after you have your jab, you've got to wait for 15 minutes to see if you have any adverse reactions. But no, it was absolutely fine. Very pleased to have had it. And I see now they can start vaccinating people who are aged 40 to 49, who are slightly younger than me. But hope that's a good sign and they'll be able to roll it out and everyone will have it soon.
Well, it's good to hear that your vaccination went well there, Bambos, but also I think it adds to the plethora of news items about how well the vaccination scheme is going. Obviously, there are people with legitimate concerns and reasons why they don't want to or can't have the vaccine, but I'm trying to persevere with all these interviews with MPs to kind of highlight that vaccines are, on the whole, very safe. And this is something that we will get onto a little bit later about the misinformation around vaccines. But continuing the good news about vaccines, Bambos, we do have to take a look at the fact that you had a great visit to the COVID-19 Vaccine Centre at Winchmore Hill Practice. What were the spirits like there, Bambos?
People I speak to are very, very happy. They couldn't wait to get through the door and actually have the vaccine. Staff and volunteers at Winchmore Hill Practice were all very very professional. You know, they're there with keen to have a good flow of people coming through, and it was very efficient, very well done, and they were happy to be part of something that was so positive. So very impressed by all the volunteers and the staff who were making the vaccines happen. And the mood was one where people, you know, saw this as giving them hope. And that's very much something that we all want to maintain. And hopefully we'll be out of the lockdown soon.
just moving it on to possible problems with vaccination in terms of the numbers getting to centres. And after I interviewed Daisy Cooper last week, she actually highlighted on her social media feeds and has put it in newspapers that the numbers of vaccines being delivered to the Batchwood Centre in St Albans has actually been slowing and lacking in the last few weeks. Is this something that we have seen happen in Winchmore Hill area as well, or have the numbers been a little bit more stable and better managed in your local constituency?
Well, from what I can gather, the supplies arrive once a week, and then the appointments are done according to the supplies that have received. So sometimes you may not even know that you've got a shortage, or there's been a shortage, I should say, because it depends on whether you get called up to have your vaccine. So I think there are, but I did notice just watching the news recently, the number of vaccines has gone down by about 100,000. So it was, so this week I saw that the numbers vaccinated on Monday were in the 300,000 as opposed to like the 500,000. So I don't know if that's a supply issue or if there's some other issue behind it. There is obviously things like vaccine hesitancy within some communities. And I think that's it's concerning in London, because in London, we seem to have vaccinated fewer people than other parts of the country. And I think there is a certain degree of vaccine hesitancy within some communities and certain people. But that aside, I think it's... I've not had any complaints about supply shortages, but it's something that I'll be monitoring quite carefully.
One thing that Enfield does seem to have combated and got on top of is the coronavirus rate in the area. At the moment, it's 72 per 1,000 individuals, and that's well below the UK average. But why I raise this is it's been a big change from about a month ago, where the cases were sky high and actually some of the worst in the UK. How has this big turnaround happened, Bambos?
I think it's a number of things. So first of all, I want to say a big thank you to Enfield Council and the local primary, the local CCG and the NHS, who have actually helped bring around this change. So part of it is the people have been obeying lockdown, but also people have been, Enfield's been very good at setting up test centres. So people that are asymptomatic and want to get tested can get tested. So I got tested just before New Year at the centre up by what used to be Southgate Library. Again, that was a very quick and easy process. And I think Enfield's been good at setting up a lot of the lateral flow test centres. So I think the organisation behind it's been very good, as has the vaccine rollout. So the vaccine will obviously give you protection. So the more people that are vaccinated, the fewer of those people will become infected and end up in hospitals. So I think that's also leading to fewer people contracting the virus. So I think all in all, it's a combination of things. But yeah, hats off to all those concerned in organising things around that.
Yes, we can praise a lot of individuals in the community, across the community, because it has been a great effort by a great number of individuals. And another success story here, we're really starting this interview with a lot of positivity. And one of the biggest successes has been the vaccination centre that was set up at the Dugdale Centre. But moving it on to a bit of a worry within the community, there was plans to turn this Dugdale Centre, which is a community centre, into offices. Will the Enfield Council now reconsider some of these plans going forward? Is this something that you would back a reconsidering of it so that it can continue with its general local community usage?
Well, I very much support the provision of culture and the availability of cultural centres in local communities. So I think that that's very important. I don't know what options Enfield Council has looked at in relation to the Dugdale Centre, but clearly then, you know, I don't know what the needs are either. So it's something that I'm willing to find out more about. Obviously, councils are facing huge pressures on their budgets, and there have been a number of staff laid off in recent years across all councils throughout the country in the last 10 years because of austerity. I know Enfield Council are going to be setting their budget very soon, and I don't know what role the Douglas Centre plays in that, but I'm willing to find out more information about this, because it's it would be a shame that if the budget pressures dictate, then that might be a better use for the Dugdale Centre for Enfield Council. I don't know. It's not a decision that I've been involved in.
Yeah, the discussion point has been around savings, but there is obviously the flip side there with community individuals. It has great access in terms of a local train station, bus services, and so to have to move a lot of community gatherings might make it a bit harder. So I think that is a positive move there, Bambos, that if you look into that and maybe deliver us maybe next month's discussions on something that might be going forward there. But despite declaring a climate emergency nearly 2 years ago, Enfield Council's pension fund remains invested in some of the world's most polluting companies, including companies implicated in the denial of climate science and those who continue to lobby against climate action. Why is the council taking so long to match words with action, Bambos?
Again, this isn't an area that I'm fully versed in. I mean, clearly it would be, we don't want to be investing in organisations that contributes to contribute carbon into the atmosphere. So, but sometimes it's not that easy just to withdraw huge pots of money that have been invested for a number of years from a certain pot of funds. So clearly there's a bit of untangling that needs to happen there. But, you know, I know that there is the desire in the council to do this. And I don't know why it's taking so long to do that, but I'm sure that they'll be on top of it and get it done as soon as they can.
Talking about local governance there, Bambos, and of course very soon we do see the London mayoral elections coming up, but in October of this year we will see the extension of the ULEZ for areas including Enfield. Drivers with older cars that do not meet the emission standards will have to pay £12.50 per day to travel into the zone. It seems a little bit hard to understand that a Labour leader would introduce a measure that seems to punish London's poorest, as some economists have argued, especially at a time of COVID. If ULEZ is inevitable, Bambos, then surely it would be sensible to hold off for a year until the economics of many poor families are more stable. Is this an idea that you'd back, or are there other reasons why ULEZ has to go ahead?
Well, I think there has to be. The problem is the air pollution kills, and we can't get away from that. So we need to take action to make sure that air pollution is reduced, and it's still way too high in London. So action needs to be taken. Now, my Ford Focus is quite old, so I'm not sure mine would actually, I'd probably have to pay if I was driving it around in the ULEZ zone. I know that in the past there have been scrappage schemes where you can actually trade your car for something that's less polluting, but we do need to look at other alternatives as well. So we need to look at using public transport, and walking, cycling, and other alternatives to the car use. I think long-term, that's going to be the only way forward. Cars will get cleaner and more efficient. So we're looking at electric cars coming on stream. I know Enfield Council is rolling out the points at where you can charge your electric vehicle. So I think that's going to be the way forward. Just as many years ago, cars went from having leaded petrol to unleaded petrol. I think things will change gradually. You've got to start somewhere, I think that you know, this has been well advertised for a number of years, so people have had time to get used to the idea, and it needs to happen sometime. So the sooner the better, because it will save lives.
Now, you've said there that something does need to happen at some time, but the government has been relaxing rules on certain things due to COVID to allow people more leeway. That is why I'm asking you this question. Plus, you said that pollution kills, but poverty does too. For many workmen now who need to travel into London with a vehicle because it has their tools, they may have to make tough decisions between paying for a new vehicle or even sometimes eating, being able to pay rent, or having to switch parts of their business due to this ULEZ zone at a time of incredible uncertainty. So if ULEZ has to go ahead like you've stated there, Bambos, do you think that local governments around London or the London government itself needs to step in and take more affirmative action for this switch over to help out individuals who are seemingly being punished? These schemes could help waylay the costs to businesses, small and large, who are affected by this increase in payments at a time when there's huge uncertainty in the economy.
I mean, I think the availability of public transport, we're so networked in London that I think for many people, public transport is certainly within the ULEZ zone is pretty good. And I think people do need to look at alternatives there. Yes, I think if possible, there should be certain benefits that people can seek to try and reduce the impact on them. But clearly, TfL and, you know, have lost a huge amount of money in relation to lost revenues in public transport, because people are travelling far less because of COVID and lockdown measures. And so that's had a huge impact on TfL's finances. So what they can actually afford to offer is another issue. And they've not been given as much support as they'd like from the government. So there are challenges in relation to TfL's budget in relation to that. But if possible, then I think if money was available, then certainly some incentives wouldn't be amiss.
Bringing it back to a discussion point I raised a little bit earlier, and we're going to talk about misinformation, because you asked the government to get tougher on social media companies, especially over things like COVID vaccination, conspiracy theories or hoaxes. What rules and regulations would you like to see in place?
So the first thing is, my question is around anti-vax misinformation. So clearly there is stuff being put out there why people shouldn't take the vaccine, which is totally false, and there are conspiracy theories out there. If people read that and take that as truth, then they may not take the vaccine, and that could cost them their lives. Because so far we've had over 120,000 people die from coronavirus. And if you're dissuaded from taking the vaccine because of something that you've read, which is false, then that's, for me, is wrong. So one of the things that I'd be very keen on is for anything that's online that is proven to be false or conspiracy theory should be taken down as quickly as possible, and that people aren't forced to, you know, don't believe everything they see online and are then sort of persuaded down a different path, and which leads to either them dying or somebody else close to dying. So I think sort of making sure that the social media companies take swift action in taking stuff down is very important. I think also there needs to be, we're going to have the online harms bill coming sometime soon. And I know that people have got concerns, not just about anti-vax content on social media, but things around sort of hate speech and things that cause distress and harm other people. So I think we do need to look at what is out there and make sure that things are properly regulated, and that information that is false or harmful is taken down and done so as quickly as possible.
Almost continuing the conversation, because this is very much linked to this, but the UK's election watchdog has urged to investigate whether non-party campaign groups collaborated to flood social media with anti-Labour attack ads, as Open Democracy recently revealed a series of so-called third-party campaign groups spent more than £700,000 attacking Jeremy Corbyn and Labour policies during the 2019 election campaign, without declaring any of these donors as well. Does this put democracy under threat, Bambos? And with your proposed rules and regulations on social media, would that also encapsulate electioneering?
Yeah, absolutely. I think our election rules as they stand are not fit for purpose because they don't deal with social media. They don't deal with the with posts that people can pay lots of money for, which isn't shown to be contributing to a particular election fund. So we do need to get up to speed with our election law so that it does take into account what's happening in the 21st century. And at the moment, we're nowhere near doing that. So certainly I would like to see things like that being taken into account because it just gives an unfair advantage to an organisation that's got very deep pockets to have got a particular vested interest in the outcome of the election. So yeah, I would like to see more regulation in that sphere. And we do need to revamp our election laws to make sure that things like this don't happen.
Finally, with the discussions of democracy under threat, we must also talk about the governmental attitudes towards education. Last November, there was a shift in the way that history could be taught in schools, with an emphasis on certain sources being allowed, whilst others no longer being given permission. This week, the National Union of Students said there is no evidence for a freedom of speech crisis on campus, but the government is stepping in with ideas such as a free speech champion and imposing certain restrictions on universities that the government feels are breaking rules around free speech. Bambos, are you worried by this legislation here that is dictating what can and can't be discussed in the free institutions of universities, but also in the classrooms across the UK? Is this a worry going forward?
Well, there's two issues there. So first of all, about the curriculum. So the curriculum is something that you do need to have like a core of what goes into a curriculum in schools and stuff. But I do think that teachers also need to have the freedom to teach and get the best results of the children they're teaching. It shouldn't be so restrictive as it is now. Now, whether that's should go on to universities, this is an issue about freedom of speech and about whether as part of the council culture, you should ban people from coming up with very unfashionable views, if I can term it in that way. I think that the best way to defeat somebody is to actually, in an argument, is to actually understand their argument and expose it for the sham that it is. So to do that, you have to hear the argument and then be able to debate it and destroy the argument when you have the chance to debate it. So I'm, for me, as long as the, as long as what's been said isn't inciting people, isn't causing hatred and incitement, then I'm very reluctant to see any limitations on freedom of speech. And I do think it needs to be measured. But I do think there are parameters. So we do need to make sure that those parameters are there to actually limit what can and can't be said. But as long as we're within those parameters, then we should be supporting freedom of speech.
So would you say from your position, Bambos, that this is actually the opposite of free speech, that this is not enhancing discussions, as you've mentioned there, having proper debates? This is actually going to have the opposite effect and actually limit a lot of people's free speech in this country, in educational settings, but setting the discourse across the country.
Well, it does make me laugh that the party that calls themselves the Party of the Libertarians are so keen to actually try and shut down free speech. So this really isn't a priority that anyone is like seeking at the moment. So, and I don't know why they decided to embark down this path. I think the idea that you'd have an organisation that would regulate what can and can't be said is very much out of an Orwell novel, and I do think that we are descending down the path of 1984 and Big Brother is watching you. So I do think it's a daft proposal from the government, and I think that you'll probably find there'll be lots of opposition on the Tory benches to it.
One last discussion point before we move into the community questions. And this week, a lot of Labour supporters were left feeling disappointed with the new position that Labour seemed to be taking over taxes, with the budget coming up very, very soon. One kind of description has been that the opposition to the small increase in corporation tax now tacitly means that Labour are supporting an increase in austerity benefit cuts further down the line. Can you explain Keir Starmer's thinking in this new Labour positioning?
Yeah, well, clearly we're going to be coming out of lockdown very, very soon. And businesses, I had a meeting this afternoon with a number of local businesses. They're on their knees. They're struggling to survive. And the idea that you've saddled them with tax straight after COVID would just destroy them. That will kill jobs. And that would lead to huge problems in the economy. So I think we need to be quite measured right now as to making sure that they get the support that they need. So, you know, personally, I think that taxing wealth is the right thing to do. So I think wealth taxes actually do can actually go to make people's lives better. But we need to see what's in the budget. And I'm not the you know, I'm not the Shadow Chancellor. I'm not the Shadow Treasury team. So that's my own personal view. But we'll see what comes out of the budget. So it's, you know, I think people need to be focusing more on what Rishi Sunak's going to say, who he's going to be taxing, because the bill for COVID is going to be paid for somehow. But at this present time, I'd be against sort of taxing small businesses because I think it will be really unfair on them.
Fellow Labour MP Diane Abbott this week actually explained her feelings and summarising some of Labour supporters' feelings as well, stating that campaigning for the UK Labour leadership, Keir Starmer pledged to reverse the Tory cuts in corporation tax. Keir Starmer's words were, "No stepping back from our core principles." However, with this discussion point that I'm giving to you, Bambos, surely this is a step back. He's now opposing putting up corporation tax. Is this not a reversal on what he has described as one of Labour's core values?
Well, we don't know where we're going to be at the next election. So let's see where we are in 2024 and how the land lies there. It'd be absolutely crazy to make a commitment now that might not be a valid commitment when you're running for election. Things might be very different then, and the whole landscape might be different. So let's wait and see.
So let's move on to the community questions, Bambos. And as always with these discussions, Radio Verulam is here to help the community, and we called for questions for you. And just to remind people, you can email jason.mckenna@radioverulam.com through this month until Bambos comes on again next month if you missed out this time and want to send something in. But Susan has sent in a question saying, "I saw on Twitter that you gave backing to the Dogs Trust. The RSPCA's data shows that their inspectors now investigate more than 185,000 incidents every year. Do you think that more needs to be done to protect animals' rights in law?"
Yes, I do. I think we need to have stiffer sentences for animal cruelty. But not just that, we need to make sure we invest in the people who are responsible for prosecuting prosecuting and investigating cruelty to animals. At the moment, it's a very small force, and we do need to make sure that their numbers are expanded. The RSPCA do some of the work, but there is actually a dedicated police section that deals with animal cruelty, and their numbers are way too low. We need to invest in them as well.
And I do have to ask, Bambos, do you have a pet yourself? Do you have a dog? Or is this just because you wanted to help out that charity?
I love animals. I would certainly have a pet, but unfortunately living in a first floor flat probably it wouldn't allow it to the space it would need. So in order to not be cruel to animals myself, I've decided not to own one at this present time. But my parents, they had cats in the past, and I was absolutely loved the cats. So yeah, I'm a big animal lover, but I don't have any pets myself.
Another discussion point that you raised this month, another campaign that you brought awareness to, was something that Nina is very pleased that you have done. You had a meeting with the Enfield branch of the National Autistic Society. She said, "I want to thank you for raising awareness for this." And she wanted to ask, what further efforts will you put in to help improve things for those with autism?
Yeah, there's a number of campaigns that I've been working on. So one of them is about face coverings. So some people with hidden disabilities can't wear face coverings. But this is sometimes misunderstood by people who might see that individual in the public space and start yelling abuse at them for breaching lockdown measures. So I think there needs to be an awareness campaign about people with autism who, and other hidden disabilities, who can't always wear a face covering when outside. There's an issue about employment as well, because people with autism have difficulty in accessing jobs. It's an issue that's problematic across the board with people with disabilities. And there are steps that employers can take to make it easier for people with autism to seek employment. So again, that's something that I'm going to be pushing for to see if we can actually, educate people about that. And also another matter that somebody raised was just about the, just when people go to get their vaccine, sometimes the centres are not very friendly for people with autism. So the lighting and the colouring sometimes may cause, they might find it not conducive to being in a calm sort of situation. So I do think that's something we can certainly focus on. So those are some things that I've been and will be following up.
Michael has raised awareness about the homeschooling situation. He said it has been hard homeschooling in lockdown, but Labour has called a mass rollout of devices and other ideas for helping underprivileged students and parents alike. Michael asks, have these plans had any progress so far?
Well, from what we've seen, we've put pressure on the government to get more devices out there. They have done to a certain degree through Labour pressure, but it's been too little too late in my view, because it's not just about the devices, it's also about having the data. So some people don't have a good broadband at home, so they might need dongles and other things to be able to access data, or they might need SIM cards for certain devices. So there has been an issue with accessing data, and if you don't have that access to data, then you can't learn online. And also, even some of my friends who are middle class, have decent broadband, if they're on at the same time as their child, they find that they'll get kicked out of the meeting whilst their child is trying to learn online. So it's still not ideal, and much more needs to be done. So we're certainly trying to keep the pressure on the government to do more to make sure that you don't have kids who are unable to access remote learning. So we need to make sure that they do get the learning that they should get in school remotely, and that they're not left behind.
So there has been a lack of commitment so far from the government over this issue.
They haven't done anywhere near enough from what they should do yet.
So let's move it to Una's question. and she's again bringing up Sir Keir Starmer's stance on a situation. She explains that she was saddened to see Sir Keir Starmer would not call for Mr. Hancock to resign over the court ruling. She explains that it annoys her that people are describing the actions of him and other Conservative ministers as cronyism or other bywords that deflect from widespread corruption. Why is the opposition not doing more to call this out? And she's asked, what is the benchmark for a government minister to be sacked?
Well, I think half a dozen of the cabinet should have resigned by now, but clearly they are shameless and won't be resigning. And I do think, therefore, even if you call them to resign, if they're not going to do it, what's the point of calling it out in the first place? And actually, by them staying in position, so people can actually see how shameless and they are and how incompetent they are, is actually probably more beneficial to the Labour Party than them resigning and having maybe somebody more competent in their place. So I do think that, number one, they're not going to resign. They're not going to do it. If Boris Johnson won't resign as Prime Minister, then I can't see Matt Hancock or anyone else resigning over something like this. So I focus on things we can do, and what we have been able to do is expose the Tory cronyism in relation to government contracts for PPE and other things. And I think we've done that quite effectively. And we just need to keep sort of hammering that home and make sure people are aware of it, because the money that they've given away to people who have not been able to come up with the goods has been absolutely staggering. And that money could have been spent in helping people who are vulnerable and who actually need the help, rather than going to the pockets of their rich mates.
You've mentioned the word cronyism there, and just reiterating Una's point, do you think that the word is actually a deflection from the use of the word corruption, or do you think that that is not a fair description from Una there and other questioners of the government?
Well, cronyism is one thing. It's corruption. You'd have to show that there was some degree of bribery or some inducement or other, and I don't think that has been made out from what I've seen. But certainly there are people that have links to the Tory party who have had contracts that have not been properly scrutinised or properly advertised. So I do think there is a distinction between the two. One might lead to the other, but at the moment I can't see the evidence that proves corruption. And we have to be clear, because words have meanings. And so cronyism, yes, corruption so far, I haven't seen any evidence of that.
I do want to ask you, Bambos, is there a problem with holding ministers accountable for actions? Because as you explained there has been discussions around other actions of other governmental ministers and other calls for resignations. Is there legislation that should be put in place or another process that is not part of Parliament that maybe would make ministers more accountable to the people?
Well, there's always been conventions in Parliament, but those conventions seem to have been ignored. I mean, to use the example of Priti Patel, she was found to have breached the ministerial code in relation to bullying allegations of her staff. But she hasn't resigned, and Boris Johnson has decided to keep her. So there is a problem that many of these issues are linked to convention, particularly if you're an office holder, if you're a minister. So there are different rules for ministers, but because those rules aren't necessarily written down in black and white, and sometimes it's hard for that to happen, then you have to rely on the conventions that have gone on in the past. And I do think we need to return to the observance of those conventions a lot more.
Chris is bringing up an issue around local gyms, and he said that he wanted more clarification as the information seems to be a little bit confusing around COVID restrictions. It seems that gyms might be able to reopen from the 12th of April, but group classes are unlikely to go ahead until the 17th of May at the earliest. He explains he doesn't see the difference in working out in close proximity in both situations. Will the government give clearer guidance nearer the time?
I hope they will. I personally think it might be an issue about sort of, I don't know if the government are going to impose restrictions as to how many people can work in a particular space safely. But obviously with, if you've got like 30 people in a room all working out at the same time, that activity might be, there might be issues around social distancing in any event. But because you'll be in that confined space, there's obviously going to be an issue around ventilation. That could lead to a greater degree of transmission of the virus if somebody has it. So I don't know what the science behind it is, but I do think more guidance is needed. So I do sympathise with Chris, and if he emails me, maybe that's something I can like push the government on.
Caroline wants to know about a situation in London that is developing and needs a bit of clarification. She's asked that 79 London train stations are platforms that are dangerous to blind or partially sighted people. She asked you to check, are any of these in Enfield Southgate area? And if so, will you help get them changed to meet all people's needs?
I'm not sure if we're talking about overground platforms, so for the trains. I mean, I do know that some of them, there has been a pot of money to made available to make some stations more accessible for disabled people. So certainly that's something I'm happy to follow up. So if Caroline wants to email me, I'm happy to follow that up for her. I do think that public transport should be accessible for all users. And the problem is some of these stations are very old, and so making them accessible for all users, including people who've got disabilities, can be quite costly for some of them. And it may be part of a long-term scheme that Network Rail have. But I'm certainly happy to find out more information for Caroline on that.
Well, that is a positive outcome of the situation there, that once again, Radio Verulam is getting an answer to your questions and to be able to put politics in action. So the final question that I want to put to you, Bambos, and hopefully get a wry smile on your face, because up to 10,000 fans could return to football stadiums by mid-May. You're a Chelsea fan, so will you try and get tickets to the Leicester match at the end of the season? And I think it would be of interest to the Radio Verulam sport fans. Do you have any football traditions when you go to a match?
Well, first of all, I would love to get a ticket. That would be, if it's available, I'll certainly be applying for one myself. Although I imagine there'll be a lot of people seeking to get hold of a ticket. So I imagine I'll be quite low down in the queue for that. When I used to go to matches on a more regular basis, I'd usually meet a friend of mine. We'd go for a pint and a burger before the game, have a chat about things, and then sort of wander in sort of about sort of half an hour before the game, just soak up the atmosphere. So that's pretty much what I would normally do. But I haven't done that for a while, because I've not been to a match in, for well over a year now.
Yes, I think everybody in terms of sport, in terms of fans, will be looking forward to returning to stadiums. But for now, I do have to thank you again for your time today, Bambos, and reminders to people that if you didn't have your question answered this time again, Bambos will be returning next month, so do send them in. But for now, thank you, Bambos.